Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilken. Mike Hochmeister is our guest. We're talking about critical thinking. A few more minutes with him, a couple emails to respond to, and then we'll be talking with Dr. Alan Carlson about family-based economy. Very interesting ideas from Dr. Carlson this time. Mike, here's an email from Steve in St. Louis. He says, how do you perform critical thinking with a person who is very postmodern in their thinking? That is, they don't believe in absolute objective truth.
They don't, wow. I would still say that hopefully that if you, I guess the way I'm looking at critical thinking, and you're talking with someone who's believing that if they can see, you know, concrete, something concrete, something that you can show them or give them examples to support whatever it is that you're talking. I guess it would specifically, you know, I'd need to know exactly what it is that he was trying to prove to this other person, you know, as far as which aspect, what it is that he was trying to prove to the postmodern person.
Would it help to show that, like we did earlier in our conversation, show that postmodern person that while they may say they don't believe in absolute truth, they live their life as though there were absolute truth? I mean, if their checkbook is, if their checks start bouncing, they call the bank. They don't say, no, I still believe there's money in my account.
Well, my first thought that I had was I was going to maybe do a little Socratic questioning, if you would, and just, you know, ask questions that might hopefully, you know, that they would answer and then kind of steer it towards, you know, an area where I would be able to, you know, hopefully be able to present my points a little bit more with the information that they had given me.
Oh, that's great. That is great advice. Ray in Bel Air, Michigan, emails us, and he says, I've found that our schools no longer teach the art of critical thinking. This has become a problem in catechizing both children and adults. To remedy this, and he's speaking here as a pastor, mm-hmm. I require my confirmants to take notes on Sundays and give me the theme of the readings in the sermon, and I've seen some improvement in the kids I serve. Your thoughts there, Mike?
I think that's, to me, I think that's a great way as far as to engage people. I know that when you have people actually taking notes, they're having to utilize multiple senses, which means their brain is active even more. They're writing down, they're listening, and it's also it's forcing them to figure out exactly what the theme is. They have to determine what that is. So that's a great way to get them involved and hopefully more a part of the process.
Mike, tell us a little bit about Concordia University St. Louis Center.
Okay, we are a Christian liberal arts university, like you said, located here in St. Louis. We're geared for the working adult. We are an accelerated program, and what I mean by that is that our classes are 4 to 6 weeks long. You meet one night a week from 6 to 10 p.m. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. So if you're working full-time, you could still come to class. That, you know, we do expect you to do reading and homework on the side, but it does allow you to pursue your education while you are working full-time. We've got associates, bachelor's, and an MBA program. Our bachelor's, we've got a theology program, which is brand new this fall. We have business management, we have human resource management, criminal justice, and general studies.
Folks, you can find out more about Concordia University St. Louis Center by calling them 314-984-8840, 314-984-8840, or just look at the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, professional education with a personal touch, Concordia University St. Louis Center. Mike Hochmeister is director of Concordia University St. Louis Center, and there he teaches a course titled Critical Thinking and Creativity. Mike, thanks for being our guest, and thanks for the few extra minutes.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Have a good afternoon.
And you as well.
Thanks.
There couldn't be anything probably more useful on a day-to-day basis for the Christian other than the Word of God, than the mind that God has given us. And He has given us, as we confess as Lutherans, our reason and all our senses, and still preserves them. In spite of our fall, in spite of our inability to think the way He has created us to think, in spite of our fallen mindset that we constantly use to distort the world around us and our ideas, God still preserves them. Why? So that we might hear His word and believe it and serve our neighbor in love in this world. Joining us for the next hour or so, Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, International Secretary for the World Congress of Families, and author of a very interesting book. I've read nothing like it lately. It's called Third Ways, How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economies and Why They Disappeared. Dr. Carlson, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Always glad to be with you.
Why is it that Christians and social conservatives are very leery of big government, but not so leery of big business?
Well, I think they've fallen into the sort of the political alignment that that the so-called Reagan coalition of the late 70s and 80s, which in some ways made a lot of sense. This was back when communism really was the great threat around the globe, and communists threatened both the free economies and the ability to own private property, as well as families and religion. It was atheistic and very anti-family. And the Reagan coalition kind of bound all this together, fused it together, as some have said, into a coalition that opposed, tried to face down communism, and in fact, by and large, did. And so I still think we have this legacy that, well, big business is our ally, but I'm not sure if it is anymore. In fact, I think in many respects it has its interests which have nothing to do with the interests of the family.
You make the case late in your book that in some cases kind of a lack of wariness with regard to big business has produced, in effect, for the average person and the family, a situation not unlike that for those who lived under communism.
Well, that's the key insight by one of the authors I look at, Hilaire Belloc, an English Catholic writer in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, who developed the concept of what he called the servile state. And he said when big business and big government consummate their merger, what we will have left is the servile state, where workers basically work for fairly minimum wage jobs or low wage jobs for the corporations. He might have had something like Walmart in mind, while the government is there to provide them sort of their basic safety net and social services. And he called it the servile state, and by that he really meant it was a new kind of slavery, where people would become slaves of a sort of a combine of big business and big government.
Is God a freewheeling, open market capitalist?
Well, you know, there's some interesting parallels, parables in the New Testament, which kind of go both ways. Well, one parable of the talents, where Jesus is clearly teaching that one needs to be should invest wisely, and in fact should not sit on an asset, but should try to make it grow, to earn some money, expand your capital. And if that's what we're talking about, and in fact, if everybody should be doing that, and everybody should have property, and if that's what it means to be a capitalist, yes, then God is a capitalist. But the problem that Belloc, Chesterton, and other writers that I look at get at is that that's not how capitalism, the modern capitalism, tends to work. It tends to aim towards monopoly. It tends to try to manipulate and control the central government to its ends and benefits. It tends to ignore the needs of local communities and families. And I think all of those tendencies, all of those trends, are certainly not things that at least I would guess, God would smile on.
Are there only two choices? I mean, some would say, look, this is the world we live in, Dr. Carlson. There's state socialism, and then on the other side, there's unrestrained free market capitalism. And if you ask me, I'll take the unrestrained free market capitalism as the lesser of two evils. Are those the only two choices?
Well, the movements and people I describe in my book say no, that there are, there is, there should be, there can be, and there have been third ways, which have tried to find a middle course that rest primarily on private property. I think all third way advocates read very strongly, even more strongly than capitalists, in private property. Private property being so important that everybody should have some, not just a few of the wealthy. And that society should be set up and property markets should be set up to make sure that excessive concentration of land and other forms of private property does not occur. So in that sense, what I describe are several attempts, both for the peasant democracies in early 20th century Europe, the attempt after the Russian Revolution by Alexander Chayanov, a truly great agrarian economist, to try to preserve private property and a free peasantry in Russia from the Bolsheviks, all the way to the effort by a poorly understood group called the Swedish Socialist Housewives, who actually tried to preserve homes premised on their being homemakers in a socialist society in Sweden.
Why has America never had, you write a great deal about European Christian, attempts at European Christian democratic parties, based on property, based on family as the building block and the basic unit of, really, of self-governance. Why has America never produced a Christian democratic party?
Part of it is our the structural of our election system. Christian democratic parties, which had a huge influence in Europe after World War II, and still do to some degree, they thrive best in systems that have proportional representation. That is, when you go to the ballot box, you don't vote for a candidate per se. You would vote for a party. And then if, say, a party got 40% of the votes, 40% of the delegates or to the parliament would be coming from that party. So the party list would determine who serves in parliament. It's a centralized system in a way without that direct representation system we have here. But it allows a what I would call a party with a clear worldview, like Christian democracy or, indeed, like socialist parties and other forms of parties, farmers' parties or peasant parties, to with a very clear worldview and a very clear agenda. It allows them to win seats in parliament and, in most cases, become parts of coalition governments. We don't have that system over here. Also, the other thing that's different is that Christian democracy in Europe was born in the 19th century in reaction to the French Revolution, which was seen as anti-Christian, very socialist, very anti-family, all of which I think were true characterizations. And most of the Christian democratic parties, notably the one in Holland, which was called the Anti-Revolutionary Party, and it was a Protestant Christian democratic party, grew out of reaction and revulsion over what the French Revolution had produced. And in the U.S., to be honest, we never, most Americans at that time and to this day still don't see the French Revolution in so, as dark a term as that.
Now, I got to know, why is that? The French Revolution in Europe is considered to be one of the worst things that ever happened. And the Europeans know it full well. Why are Americans kind of, you know, it was bad, there was some guillotining going on, but in the end, it was good for everybody.
Well, I think we tried, certainly as people back in the late 18th century, our founding fathers, you know, tried to see it as a sort of a reflection of the American Revolution. Edmund Burke, the English politician and writer, was brilliant in pointing out the huge differences. Burke supported the American Revolution, even though being an Englishman, as a statement and a step forward of liberty. But he condemned the French Revolution because instead of conserving the basic and primary social units of small communities and families and property, the French Revolution devastated everything in its path. It was radical. Nothing stood in its way. They didn't like the calendar that existed. They created a new calendar. They didn't like the weights and measures system. They created another one that was more rational. They leveled everything they saw in front of them. And Burke said that's a true revolution of the worst sort. But Americans didn't quite get that back then. And I think they saw the French as, well, they're having something like we did, a little excessive. And indeed, the United States still saw Britain as its primary enemy, really till the end of the wars of the French Revolution. We fought the British in at least a tacit alliance with the French in 1812.
Let's come back to big business, if we could. How much of big business, in what particular ways that impact the family, how much of big business is unfriendly to the family, this basic building block of human authority?
Well, at the theoretical level, you'd have to see that the purpose of business is not to nurture communities or nurture families. It's to make a profit and secure market share. That's what businesses do. Family bonds, like all other traditional bonds, can get in the way of that. First of all, capitalism wants the maximum allocation of labor to the right places. And it may be that a father should be working in one place and a mother should be working someplace else. Also, the capitalism is never like the mother at home. The homemaker has always been seen as a waste of human resources. She'd be better off to be in the labor pool where she can help hold wages down. Capitalism, in theory, has always opposed the family wage principle. Back in the 1920s, it was still openly opposing efforts by state and federal governments to regulate child labor. Again, it wanted access to labor, again, to keep costs down. And generally, it's always favored free immigration. Again, it wants free, it wants the cheapest labor it can get. Again, why? Well, for logical economic reasons, to keep labor costs down so they can maximize profit and market share. So you have to look at it. Just business has a different incentive structure, and families, just like local communities, get in the way unless there are other variables brought in. Many family-held businesses are tied to their community and feel an attachment to their workforce that makes them behave differently. And I can point to many examples of those kinds of businesses which see themselves as part of a community, will stay there no matter what happens. They won't move the jobs to China. But the mega corporations of the modern world have almost no attachments to place. They are free-floating combines of capital and enterprise, and they will go, again, where labor is cheapest, or at least cheap labor is going to be found, rather than investing in communities. They'll abandon a community at the drop of a hat if they can see an advantage to do so.
We're talking about family-centered economy. Dr. Alan Carlson, author of the book Third Ways, is our guest. We're giving this book away to listeners with best questions or comments during our conversation, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issues ETC at KFUO.org. Let's go to the phones and see what Mark has to say, calling from his car. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I'm so thrilled by everything you were just saying. I almost forgot my question. But I've been reading about the relationship of money to a society, and specifically fractional reserve banking, inflation, and fiat currency. I mean, it's most poignant, I think, in the French Revolution, the German Reichsmark of the 20s, and now American dollar through the last 100 years. I was just wondering if you might be able to explore that area a little bit, the overthrow of sort of social institutions in any society by this increase of the shekel, so to speak.
All right, Mark, thank you very much. I think it's touching a soft spot there in Dr. Carlson's heart.
Well, it's a very good question, and most of the writers I dealt with in this book don't go deeply into monetary issues, which may be a weakness on the case of some of them. But your caller is exactly right there. The modern fiat money system, which rests really pretty much just on faith, in the end. As late as 1964, here in the United States, you could still take your dollar bill down to a bank and you get yourself a silver dollar in return. And as late as 1933, you could take your $20 note or something down to the bank and get yourself a $20 gold piece back. Those days are long gone. You know, the money supply is based on a whole different set of concepts, ultimately which rely upon faith in the system. And if that faith disappears, there are going to be problems. The again, this I think underscores the fragility of the modern economy, which is again is another point that the distributist writers I've mentioned always talked about. They were widely criticized by the orthodox free market economists for being fanciful in their belief that everybody could have property, would know how to use it. Their response was that the modern free market economy rests on a much deeper leap of faith, and in fact has repeatedly shown itself to be remarkably fragile to the slightest problem that comes along, or more remarkably, it's always been an unsettled vehicle. The most recent or the collapse of the housing market, which we're just the throes of, maybe just at the start of right now, it threatens to pull the whole economy down. It was just another example of a regular, repeated surge of speculation, which, if anybody calmed down for a moment and stepped back, could see was not going to last. It didn't have any foundation to it. And now we're paying the price in a weakened dollar, in a falling stock market, trade imbalance. We've got some serious problems again as a result of an economy that rests on a new kind of faith that really isn't very Christian.
Scott's listening in St. Charles. Scott, thanks for waiting.
Yes, I have a question. I work for a Fortune 100 corporation, and we often find ourselves enslaved, whether we would like it or not, to the market share paradigm, the accounting paradigm. We don't have a mechanism, even when we seek one, we don't have a mechanism to measure our social or our cultural impact. Can you talk a little bit about that, sir?
That's a brilliant question, Scott. Thank you very much. I mean, really about business looking at what it's doing to families or not doing to families.
Well, it's a very precise and important question. And it is true, our accounting systems right now don't take into account about half of human economic activity, or maybe even more than half. Specifically, our accounting systems don't count, say, the economic contribution of a mother who makes a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for her child, or the father who mows his own lawn, or the woman who nurses her child. I mean, to be frank, these are all economic acts. But they're not counted, they're not monetized, and in the end, they're ignored by policymakers, by economists, with a few exceptions like Gary Becker, who've tried to find a way to bring them into account.
Let's take a break right here and allow you to finish that thought on the other side of the break. Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We're talking about family-centered economies. He's president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois. International Secretary for the World Congress of Families, author of several books, including his latest called Third Ways, How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economies and Why They Disappeared. I guess the big question before we conclude with him is it possible to actually do this? Were all these attempts well-intended but ultimately destined to fail? We'll be right back.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week is Peace Lutheran in South County. This holy season, the members of Peace Lutheran cordially invite you to Family Advent midweek services Wednesdays at 6 and 7 p.m. Our Christmas Eve services include our children's service, a candlelight communion service, and a candlelight choral service, and we also worship Christmas Day. Also, Peace Men's Club invites you to browse our Christmas tree lot at the Telegraph Walmart.
Why not send a high school-age man from your congregation to Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, on the campus of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis? Taste of the Sim gives high school men the opportunity to experience seminary life. For more information on Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call 1-800-822-9545.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Retailers are working overtime to secularize Christmas, and it's not going unnoticed. Focus on the Family founder, Dr. James Dobson, is pointing out prominent corporations that are ignoring Christmas, all in the name of political correctness. Josh Montes has some examples.
The Christmas Avoidance Award goes to Pier 1 Imports, which goes out of its way to avoid the word Christmas. Repeat offenders of censoring Christmas for 06 and 07 include The Gap, Old Navy, and Banana Republic. Dr. Dobson finds the anti-Christmas trend alarming.
Not only do they not want any reference to the Christ child, but they don't even want the word Christmas, which has a long history in our culture, and they seem to want to change that.
Others are banning Salvation Army bell ringers and kettles from the premises, including Home Depot, Lowe's, Target, Toys R Us, Kohl's, Best Buy, Borders, and Circuit City.
I really can't imagine what's the big beef with bell ringers, with people standing out in front trying to raise money for hungry people and those in need. But apparently they see it that way.
Mike Johnson with the Alliance Defense Fund says the retail industry is obviously caving to empty threats by the ACLU. But he says shoppers don't have to stand idly by.
If we let our voices be heard, if we take our shopping dollars elsewhere, we send a very important message. I think that even the largest companies respond to that, because for them, in so many ways, it's really about the bottom line.
Dobson says retailers have the right to market products the way they want, but shoppers are also free to decide how they spend their money. For Family News and Focus, I'm Josh Montes.
Not all retailers have erased Christmas from their advertising. Among the Keep Christmas crowd, Amazon.com, Bath & Body Works, Big Lots, JCPenney, Sam's Club, and Walmart. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
You can share the real meaning of Christmas with your young children and grandchildren in our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November titled, What Happened to Merry Christmas? It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this new children's book at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, What Happened to Merry Christmas? Here's a happy AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Wednesday, November 28th, 2007, Harold and Gloria Heiligtag. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of their 26th wedding anniversary. Once again, we say thank you to Harold and Gloria Heiligtag of Barnhart, Missouri, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsors, and best wishes from all of us for a happy anniversary.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. In the middle of a very interesting conversation with Dr. Alan Carlson about a family-centered economy. Before the break, Dr. Carlson, Scott was on the line. I want you to be able to finish your thought. He asked the question about the need for business to be able to measure its impact on the family. Scott was saying he doesn't see any mechanism for doing that in his context. Your final thought there.
Well, again, just the one point I made is we don't have an accounting mechanism in place to bring that into the books in any way, shape, or form. It's seen most glaringly in what economists now call human capital, which in the long run is what any economy that has a future needs. And investment in human capital means the birth of babies. It means their best possible rearing so that they grow up to be healthy, happy, productive, bright, enterprising citizens. That's the most important kind of capital that any society has. But we don't count it at all. It's not included, again, in any accounting schemes. Corporations are not held to account for their investment in human capital. In fact, they just assume that investment will come from private families or from someplace. Or, more likely, they'll just, when they've worn out the human capital in one place, like, say, a Rust Belt town in the Midwest, they'll move the factory to Mexico and kind of exhaust the human capital there, and then they'll take it over to China. Again, the incentives they face place no barriers to that. And, I mean, it's rational economic behavior, but it doesn't, but the sort of the abandoned folks back home, to them, it's a different story.
J.W.'s up next calling from his car. Hi, J.W.
Hi, Hi, Pastor. Hi, Doctor. I'm extremely happy to hear you guys talking about Chesterton. I teach philosophy, and I try to bring him up when we talk about Thomas Aquinas, because I know Chesterton was not only a biographer of Aquinas, but quite a fan. And the question I'd like to hear addressed that I've not heard in a lot of books is Chesterton's views on pluralism, because I know Thomas Aquinas and the whole Christian medieval tradition back to the ancient Greeks would have held it as crazy that you could have a pluralistic society in which, you know, the most fundamental metaphysical questions guiding people's choices could be completely at odds with one another, and yet people could be considered a society when one person has the dollar bills in their eyes and another person is looking toward the cross. I'm just wondering if you could, I know that T.S. Eliot in After Strange Gods touched on this question as well. I'm just wondering if you could address that, and I'd be curious to hear what you have to say. And thanks a lot.
J.W., thank you very much. Were the distributionists pluralists too?
Generally, yes. I mean, they were a remarkably broad-minded and open people. They believed in a community of nations. They were patriots without being nationalists. They were, I think, very generous, and their form of, I guess you'd say, of pluralism was to make sure that all, as far as they could possibly do so through public policy and through culture, to make sure that all families would have access to property and to the independence that delivered property. And Chesterton himself actually was a convert to Catholicism and became a huge enthusiast for Catholicism, maybe its greatest apologist in the 20th century. But he also recognized that not everybody was Catholic, certainly not in his home native home of England. So I think he was a just about everything I know about Chesterton is just he was admirable. He was an early and energetic foe against eugenics. He was a foe against imperialism. He regularly denounced the British adventure in South Africa called the Boer War, which was open imperialism. Thought Britain should get out of the colonial business and free people. He was just about every aspect that I know about him. He was just a genuine, fine fellow.
Frank is listening in Las Vegas. Hi, Frank.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Really a fantastic conversation. I really find it interesting. Just a couple of comments. I've heard it said that on a show I was watching that America is not a nation, it's a corporation. And to a certain extent, that's true. Business 101 will teach you, just like your guest said, that the main purpose of a corporation is to maximize the wealth of the shareholders, nothing more, nothing less. And to achieve that end, they may have pro-family policies and regulations, or they may not. It seems to me that from the standpoint of family-centered economies in the United States, that I can speak for being a citizen, it all hinges on whether or not our citizens participate in their government effectively. This country came out of a terrible monopolization in previous centuries, and the culmination were the Sherman-Clayton Antitrust Act and all the antitrust laws, and the Justice Department had an entire department set up for that end to encourage what built this country, which is not capitalism, but what built this country, most people are not aware of this, what built this country is free enterprise, where there's no significant barriers to entry into particular markets. And, of course, there are now, in most of our economies now, are oligopolies. A few are still monopolies. And it seems like, and to the extent that we can participate effectively with our government to make sure there's no oligopolistic domination in the major industries, we can achieve somewhat of a pro-family type of environment, but it seems to be an experiment yet that I haven't seen it really successful in most cases. Perhaps your guest can speak to that.
All right, Frank, thank you very much. Your thoughts, Dr. Carlson?
Well, it's a very good comment. I have two reactions. One is that we have forgotten, and I try to re- re-
remember, restore the memory in people's minds in Chapter 2 of my book, we have forgotten that the United States did have a more family-friendly economy between about 1880 and 1970. We had in this country an informal system called the family wage, and it was largely driven by a cultural assumptions that men and women should be married, that the woman should ideally be a homemaker at home raising the children, and the father should be a breadwinner. It was supported by, again, custom, but also by law. The conservatives, most of them aren't aware of this, but the entire New Deal programs, including Social Security and widows' pensions, and all the things that came out of the New Deal, were driven by that same assumption of a family wage society where the father would be the breadwinner and the mother would be the homemaker. And our tax system in the 1940s and 50s was changed to recognize and support and affirm that. And this system worked reasonably well. It enjoyed the support of religious leaders, particularly from the Roman Catholic Church favored this very strongly. So did most Protestant churches. It enjoyed the support of labor unions. The capitalists didn't like it. The Manufacturers Association fought it fiercely when they could, but they eventually accepted it. And it lasted until about 1970 when the feminists pulled it down, because the feminists didn't like the assumption that women would be mothers at home. And they successfully pulled it down. There were some other changes that were taking place which made it easy for them to do so. But we had a system like that. And also the other point about corporations that he made early in his comments brought to mind a recent declaration from a major company here in the Midwest, John Deere Corporation, which announced one day a few months ago that it was going to close down arbitrarily, no longer ship tractors and other vehicles to a number of smaller farm implement dealers that had been part of the John Deere family for over 100 years. And what John Deere president said was that he said this quite openly, the John Deere Corporation is not a family. If it ever was, it no longer is. What the John Deere Corporation is, it's an international combine designed to raise profits and expand our market share around the globe. And we no longer care what happens to the little dealership in Podunk, Illinois. And he said it very bluntly, and in fact, he's right. That's the way the system works today for most of the major corporations.
Dr. Carlson, can you give us about another 15 minutes?
You bet.
All right. There are a couple questions that I have, spurred to some degree by our listeners' questions, excellent questions all. Is it true that in the founding documents of our country, Jefferson amended his famous line, life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? And I wonder, was there some insight in there into the central role that property in private hands had to play in what they must have been thinking of, not as a corporation, but as a nation based upon family-centered economy?
You're right. The old phrase, life, liberty, and property, had its roots in Lockean liberalism. Property is very important to Locke and into the founders, but they changed it to happiness. There was a fine book written, back in the 1980s, I think, by Jane Lewis, called The Pursuit of Happiness. She's an historian, and she made a very compelling case that what the founders meant by happiness in that phrase was they meant happiness to be found in one's family and around one's hearth. She quotes how the founders came to that understanding using their diaries and other speeches and so on that they made. They weren't just talking about random happiness, but they were talking about family happiness, the happiness that comes from owning one's land and property, which they still saw there, but also the happiness that would come from the family life and the small communities you would build around that. And in that sense, I think if that's what the founders meant, I'm entirely pleased with the change in phrase, because I think it goes beyond sort of the narrow confines of property and expands it into a larger matrix of human relationships, which I think is quite beautiful.
But what does it mean now, or what is it commonly perceived as meaning, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
I think today the pursuit of happiness is, has a meaning that's radically opposed to what the founders meant. Today it's just the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of whatever you want to do. It's liberty without any touching point on responsibility. This plays in again to, I think, the radical, fairly radical understanding of the free market as a is just a random collision of desires and needs that somehow will work out in the end. The advocates of the third way I describe say, no, that's not what you're going to get. You're going to get, unless there's some constraints in there, either internalized constraints among a moral people or externalized constraints imposed by culture or government, you're not going to get happiness in the end. You're going to get a lot of misery.
Dr. Alan Carlson is our guest. We're talking about family-centered economies. He is a president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, international secretary for the World Congress of Families, author of several books, including his latest called Third Ways. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727 or 505-7850. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. Here's an email from Steve in St. Louis. He says, as someone engaged in the global economy, capitalism is not a family-friendly economic system. A true free market system is more of a Darwinian system where it's survival of the fittest. A truly family-friendly economic system is one in which the role of government is to protect its citizens from the power of business. Steve goes on to say, I find it ironic that many Christians are against big government but are for big business. I place trust in government than business to protect my interest, since I am protected by the Constitution. With a business, I'll skip the sentence. As one laid off twice from large corporations, says Steve, I have little trust in business to protect my interests as well as my family. Your thoughts there, Dr. Carlson?
Well, I think that is the modern mega international corporation. They don't have the luxury. I'll give them this. They don't have the luxury of being nice to families. They don't have the luxury of not sucking as much energy and life out of their workers as they can because they are in a ruthless, grueling competition. I see it happening in my own town here of Rockford. We just, one of our last major corporations that was locally owned just got bought out yesterday. The local management team all got fired. They're being taken over by a restructuring specialist. And I guess with the factory itself will probably be closed in a year or two, and the technology and some of the machines will be moved somewhere else. That's the way the system works, unless there are constraints. And an earlier caller was right to point to the old Sherman antitrust acts and so on. They put some restraints on the ability of mega companies to crush their smaller competitors. And that, together with cultural assumptions about affirming the family wage, together with United States had a blessed experience in the 20th century. We were not we engaged in two global wars and a number of minor wars. We were never invaded. We never saw our industrial infrastructure crushed by invaders. In fact, war usually stimulated our industry. And between 1945 and 1965, most of our major industrial competitors were still recovering from a devastating war. And we had a nice time, a blessed time, actually, in retrospect. And we could afford everybody. The family wage system flourished in that system. And, in fact, the middle class was growing. The number of poor were shrinking. And the number of the very rich were also shrinking. You know, there were fairly high marginal taxes back then. And the very rich were, as a category, shrinking. We were becoming a much more middle class society, much more like each other, in retrospect, I think it was something that looks pretty good. It doesn't mean there weren't differences in income, but they were much less than they are today. You didn't have
well, say the head of Citibank or something making $200 million or something. The guy actually that proved to be much of a leader. The company is just reeling from poor leadership, but he still bails out with $200 million in parachutes. We didn't have that back in the 50s and 60s. It just wasn't seen as seemly or acceptable. So we're in a different system now where the old constraints have broken down. And the problem with the Democrats is they might put some constraints back on, but their credo toward the family is not very compelling.
Some might say that labor unions have forced big business to become less family-centered. What are your thoughts?
Well, when the labor unions had a moral purpose to them, which I think they did, they were strongly family-centered, and they insisted on a family wage. They insisted that workers be protected as family leaders. And they were mainly talking about male workers, without question. I think they had a moral purpose and a moral compass. I think today, labor unions have lost that completely. They're probably worse than the corporations in some respects, because the labor unions have become captive to other political movements, ranging from feminism to socialism. The worst aspects of the labor unions are the public unions, which almost didn't exist, say, 60 years ago, or were very minor. And there, too, we're seeing strange ideologies, say, dominating the teachers' union or the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. They've become dangerous, too. That wasn't, again, true of the old industrial unions and the old trade unions. Between 1830 and, like, say, as late as 1970, they were fervently in favor of protecting workers as family members and family leaders. And that, again, collapsed under the pressure of feminism and some other leftist ideologies that came around with new strength at that time.
Couple final questions then. I was listening to a very famous social commentator, conservative social commentator, just yesterday, and he was adjuring his audience on the radio, trust the markets, trust the markets. The markets will work all this out. He was talking about economic downturns and whatnot. And I think I've also heard him occasionally say that if, you know, the factory picks up and moves to China, then you got to move to where pick up your family and move to where the next job is. What steps can be taken to create a family-centered economy where both government and business serve the interests of the family rather than the other way around?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize what that commentator was calling for is not conservative in any means. It might be libertarian. In a way, it is. It's an extreme version of libertarianism. But the problem with the market, as he's using the phrase, is that it's entirely abstract, and it doesn't deal with real people and the real problems that people have. Yeah, you lose your job. You've spent 30 years working someplace, and the plant closes down. You lose your job, and you can't find the best job you can find is a minimum wage job at some big box store somewhere, which pays about a fourth of what you used to get. That's a huge blow. And you don't want to leave your community. You've got family there. Your children live around you. You've got friends. You've got your church. It's just, you know, it's inhuman to say, well, just pick up and move. That's in some ways just extremely inhuman. What can we do now? Well, we're not going to get back a family wage system of the old sort until people believe in that men and women are different and hold different roles in the economy as well as in families. And I don't see that happening on a broad scale anytime soon. It's probably illegal under federal laws right now to even think about it too much. We can use tax policy to strengthen and protect families, much bigger benefits tied to marriage and to particularly to the presence of children in the home. We can refigure the payroll tax system so it rewards people that bear children rather than punishes them, as it does now. We can, I think, go back to the trust-busting idea. Teddy Roosevelt was the first and greatest of the pro-family presidents in American history. He had a lot to say about protecting the family. And he saw that his trust-busting work is part of that. I think we need to do it again. The trusts are not a healthy thing. They're certainly not healthy for the country. They have no loyalties whatsoever. They're not loyal to the United States of America. let alone Rockford, Illinois, or St. Louis, Missouri. They have only one loyalty, which is to maximize market share and profit. And that's fine as far as they go, but I think it's not the highest human ideal.
Then with only 1 minute, Dr. Carlson, what ideally, without falling into the utopian dreams of the past, what ideally does a family-centered economy look like?
Well, it's a place that understands the family is the fundamental social unit, not the corporation, nor the individual. The family-centered economy recognizes that private property, particularly in land and in home ownership, is the key thing, and public policy should aim to secure home ownership on a reliable, sound basis, not on a speculative basis, but on a reliable basis to every family. It's one that recognizes that men and women are different, and that their roles in rearing children can be different, that mothers and fathers are distinct. They're just not workers to be randomly interchanged. Those at least would be some of the areas which a truly family-centered economy would recognize and would seek to protect.
You starting a political party anytime soon, Dr. Carlson? Because you can sign me up.
Well, there is a movement to create a Christian Democratic Party in America. It's kind of sputtering along, but at least the principles of that party look pretty good.
Dr. Alan Carlson is president of the Howard Center for Family, Religion, and Society based in Rockford, Illinois, international secretary for the World Congress of Families, author of several books, including his latest, Third Ways, How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economies and Why They Disappeared. You can find out more about this book at profam.org, profam.org. And I'm going to give this book away to two of our callers, to JW, who called earlier, and Scott, who is also on the line near the bottom of the hour. Thanks very much to everybody who called. And Dr. Carlson, thank you again for a very stimulating conversation.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you for having me on your show.
Folks, there is an international relief agency out there that is very friendly to the family, concerned with both body and soul, LCMS World Relief. You can find out about their efforts around the world to help the victims of natural and man-made tragedies at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or by calling 1-888-930-4438, 888-930-4438, Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. I know that there's a tendency, especially nowadays, to put our trust and to basically center our lives someplace other than where God has put us. It is quite true that if we examine Scripture, there are some basic vocations, the first of which, the one from which all of us sprung biologically, the family, mother, father, siblings, the extended family. You know, there's a reason for this, because God in his wisdom has so structured his creation to benefit his creatures. Even in a fallen world, he has still structured it through his providence to benefit his creatures materially, to, as we say in the first article of the Creed, provide all that we need to support this body and life. And we Christians who trust in Jesus Christ as our Savior, who has provided for us from above what we truly needed as fallen creatures, forgiveness of sins, life, and salvation, ought to be earnest about those things that support this body and life in service of our neighbor. Be right back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.